gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Well, boys and girls, I'm back again here in the bunker, and it is September the 26th, 2017. And are you ready for the rest of the bloody railroad wars? Here we go.
77. Railway and Vulcan iron workers rallied in support of the striking railway workers attacked by federal troops in Pennsylvania. St. Louis newspapers bannered the reports under the heading, War News. At the same time, another mass rally of workers called on the mayor to demand that troops not be dispatched to St. Louis, the city of Little Bread. Tuesday, July 24, worker committees visited hundreds of shops, asking workers to strike. Especially active were groups of coopers. 1,500 mechanics and molders organized a marching band protest through the city streets, armed with clubs and slaves. A mass night rally followed. Meanwhile, the WMP and trade union leaders had organized a strike executive committee, demanding an 8-hour day and the abolition of child labor. Fearful of the mob in the streets, which they could not control, the Marxist and trade unionists also denounced the use of violence. 25 of July, Wednesday. Railway workers shut down the yards in East St. Louis. Marching through the city, 5,000 strong with a worker at their head carrying a loaf of bread stuck on a flagpole, the strikers shut virtually every factory and shop. Cannery and stove foundry workers joined, as well as Black River Levee roustabouts. Several bakeries were looted and a dry goods store in the Northside slums. The executive committee intervened to operate essential services, running trains, distributing bread, and assuring that workers continued to process sugar at a mill facing spoiled supplies, under the guard of a 200-man worker militia. The mayor of East St. Louis, a German refugee from the 1848 Revolution, formed a special police force from strikers to maintain order in his section. The city mayor and chief of police in St. Louis properly admitted they had no control over the situation. Secretly, they began to take orders from a businessmen's vigilante force, the Committee of Public Safety, overseen by former Confederate and Missouri state militia officers. The committee requisitioned funds, supplies, and arms, issuing receipts in its own name. That same day, July 25, 1877, in London, the German Jew Karl Marx, on reading transatlantic telegraphic reports from America, hailed the events as the first explosion against the Civil War. It will naturally again be suppressed, but can very well form the point of origin of an earnest workers' party. A nice sauce is being stirred over there, and the transfer of the International to the United States may obtain very remarkable post-festum opportunities. Marx had earlier hailed Irish revolts and the American Civil War, in which his followers were active in New York City, St. Louis, etc., as the beginning of the world revolution. With the press shrieking against the rule of the rabble and comparing it to the recent bloody Paris Commune revolt in France, U.S. President Hayes decided on federal intervention. 6 companies of troops were dispatched by train from Indian Fighting in the West to St. Louis, via Kansas. They were temporarily halted by railway strikers in Kansas City and in Sedalia, Missouri. 26th day of July, Thursday, three companies of infantry and a boxcar of arms entered St. Louis and joined the Vigilante Committee of Public Safety. When workers led a mass protest rally in the streets, the frightened Executive Committee of Trade Unionists and the Marxists of the WMP counseled surrender and disassociated themselves from the mob. 27th of July, Friday. Two more companies of troops arrived with another load of arms. The businessmen's militia attacked a mass rally of workers and then arrested 75 leaders of the WMP at their headquarters, who, after a protest attack by enraged workers, had just finished officially denouncing the workers' rally. On the 28th of July, Saturday, federal troops occupied East St. Louis, breaking the strike, although scattered resistance occurred for another week. The strike had meantime leapfrogged west along the rail and telegraph lines, though Denver and Salt Lake City of San Francisco, California on the Pacific Ocean. It had now become a radical white racist struggle against Chinese scab labor and the white capitalists importing cheap Chinese coolie slaves. Radical white racists Chinese in California numbered 100,000 by 1870, brought in by large companies to work on the railroads and in gold mining operations. Working at substandard rates and living in filthy hovels and on garbage for food, the Chinese coolies caused the mass layoffs of, not only white workers, but also Hispanics. Racial animosity arose as early as the first gold rush in the 1850s. The California Mexican bandit Joaquin Murrieta specialized in the mass murder of Chinese, along with selective whites, as would Pancho Villa later in northern Mexico. A U.S. treaty signed with China in 1868 assured the full right of Chinese to enter the United States. In 1870, white labor demonstrations against Chinese scabs erupted across California. In 1871, whites in Los Angeles invaded Chinatown, sacked their quarters and killed a score of Chinese. White miners ousted Chinese from the work camps at French Canal and Nevada City. Several Chinese were lynched. The nationwide slump struck California in 1873. Whites were mass fired and replaced by Chinese. By 1877, over 16,000 white workers were unemployed in San Francisco alone. Between 1873 to 1877, capitalists brought in another 70,000 Chinese. The Chinese scabs dominated railroad construction, mining, boot and shoe manufacture, cigar making and broom fashioning. As a white capitalist said, "All I want is muscle power. I don't care if it's Chinese, white, horse, or mule." July-August 1877, white workers erupted in anti-Chinese riots. In San Francisco, white workers set fire to the Chinese coolie quarters and a lumber yard near the Pacific Mail dock, where Chinese offloaded. Five were killed and scores wounded by revolver shots. An employer's vigilante was shot to death, and one rioter was killed while slashing a fire hose. White rioters then shot two police and injured three with stones. A Chinese criminal gang, the Tong, rioted in Chinatown. In September 1877, Irishman Dennis Carney spoke to a mob of white workers across from San Francisco's City Hall. Carney shouted, "The Chinese must go," and demanded jobs and increased wages for whites. On September 21, 1877, Carney and his comrades organized a western branch of the WMP, the Workingmen's Party of California. Their platform demanded the exclusion of all Chinese, fair treatment for whites, the reform of banking practices, the granting of state land only to farmers and settlers and not to the railroads and real estate speculators, the breakup of the Central Pacific RR and other monopolies and trusts, heavy taxation of large corporations, an 8-hour day, and universal education with an emphasis on vocational training. The 23rd of September 1877, Kearny declared to a crowd that he meant to wrest government from the hands of the rich and place it in the hands of the people, and to rid the country of cheap Chinese labor. On October 29, 1877, a large mob of white workers rallied on Nob Hill, home of the rich in San Francisco. Bonfires were lit across from the mansion of George Crocker, chief of the Oriental and Occidental Steamship Line, which specialized in bringing Chinese to San Francisco. Kearny shouted that the problem could be solved by a little judicious hanging of robber capitalists. The Chinese he described as leprous, rat-eating Chinese slaves. A week later, Kearny and five aides were arrested and jailed on charges of incitement to riot. 3 weeks later, public pressure caused the charges to be dropped and the white men freed. The white workers celebrated in a mass rally on Thanksgiving Day, marching through San Francisco, 10,000 strong. In January 1878, a California state convention of the Workingmen's Party convened and called for the state government to hold a state constitutional convention and incorporate the Workingmen's Party platform into California's basic laws. A torchlight parade wound through San Francisco. On January 10, 1878, Kearny called for support not only at the ballot box, but at the bullet box, if necessary. On the 14th of January, Kearny declared that the Chinese must be ousted, if it takes the life of every white man in California. In late January, at a rally outside City Hall, Kearny threatened to lead his followers to blow up the Pacific steamship steamers and docks and to invade the Chinese quarters with firearms and infernal machines, bombs. William T. Coleman, a prominent merchant, financed 6,000 vigilantes to halt Kearny until federal forces arrived. The U.S. Navy then landed men of war in San Francisco to protect the government mail docks, as well as the nearby steamship docks for offloading Chinese slaves purchased from China merchants. Kearny was again arrested and jailed, although quickly released after public outrage. The bought California legislature passed a state law making it a felony to incite or commit acts of violence against persons or property. Back amongst his white fellow workers, Kearny began to use a code language at public rallies. For instance, the term "serve the Chinamen coffee and donuts" meant to attack the Chinese quarters with incendiaries and firearms. In the 1878 election, the Workingmen's Party elected the mayors of San Francisco, Oakland, and Sacramento, a number of judges, and one-third of the delegates to a state constitutional convention. At the state constitutional convention, the workingmen's delegates failed to win the economic demands of the white working class, but did succeed in reducing the number of Chinese allowed employment. The impoverished California wheat farm grangers had meantime outlived the grain robberies of Jew wheat speculator Isaac Friedland in San Francisco. Meanwhile, in the East, the new Greenback Party had been organized by the radical farmer grangers of the Midwest, their independent parties, and the labor reformers, the National Labor Union. The National Greenback Party ran in the 1878 midterm state and congressional elections on a platform of reduced work hours, the abolition of contract alien and convict labor, controlled immigration, banking reform, the issue of government fiat money to eliminate the privileged classes, silver coinage, the sale of public land only to actual settlers, the control of railroad and warehouse rates, the establishment of a government labor bureau, and the reform of the civil service. The National Greenback Party garnered 1 million votes in state elections, two-thirds of these from the Midwest. 14 U.S. congressmen were elected, and many state legislators. A strong showing also occurred in the South, with 22% of the vote in Mississippi, 10% in Tennessee, and 2 members elected to the state legislature in Georgia. In West Virginia, 18 state legislators were elected. In Arkansas, a fusion with the Republicans seated 7 of the latter and 7 Greenbackers. Back in California, a smear campaign by the capitalist press and the churches, Protestant and Catholic, accused Carney of taking a bribe from the railroads and of being an unchristian atheist. Carney was ousted from chairmanship of the WMP for a brief period, but soon reinstated. In late 1878, the U.S. Congress passed a bill to exclude Chinese from the United States. President Hayes vetoed the bill. Irishman Carney denounced Hayes, saying that Andy Jackson's old clothes stuffed with rags would make a better president. Agitation continued. The Knights of Labor, a radical union not only of trades and industrial workers, but also of popular assemblies of the people, adopted a tough racialist stance in its western branches, agitating against the Mongolization of America and the Asiatic plague threatening white citizen labor. In 1880, white rioters in Denver, Colorado sacked the Chinese quarters, beating and killing Chinese. That year, lame duck President Hayes negotiated a treaty with China that allowed the United States minor controls over Chinese immigration, but no right to prohibit it. American money-making in China was too important. In 1882, Congress passed a Chinese Exclusion Act over the veto of new President Cheater Arthur, who became chief executive after the assassination of President Garfield. The California WMP was torn by faction fights. Carney quit in 1881, going on to become a businessman. The party collapsed in 1882 after Chinese immigration was banned for 10 years by the U.S. government and the naturalization of Chinese prohibited. But the scab Chinese already in the U.S. continued to be a serious problem. In 1885, 28 Chinese were killed in Rock Spring, Wyoming, and whites in Tacoma, Washington burnt down the Chinese quarters. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1888 was reluctantly accepted by the faltering Chinese government in 1894 for another 10 years. Renewals continued until 1924, when national quota systems were adopted. It had a not stopped smuggling of Chinese aliens. In 1941, Chinese received quotas and citizenship. Anti-Chinese agitation also occurred on the west coast of Canada, led by the Knights of Labor. Chinese were being shipped into British Columbia as contract slaves to work on the railroads and in the mines. When Chinese intruded into lumbering and port jobs, the white workers of Vancouver exploded. In January 1887, a mob attacked the Chinese work camp by dark, driving scores of Chinamen over a 20-foot cliff into the bay below. The next day, Chinatown was raided by white workers who tied Chinese together by their pigtails and herded the lots into a steamship bound for the provincial capital of Victoria on Vancouver Island, opposite from Seattle, Washington. Special constables escorted the Chinese back under armed protection. Riots also occurred against Japanese and East Indian Hindus in 1907. The Dominion of Canada finally began to halt open immigration after a boatload of turbaned Sikhs tried to steam ashore in 1914. But, as in the United States, this would not last. The white struggle ultimately failed because although colored races were temporarily controlled, the white capitalist race traders were still left to run the United States of America. Now, as stated in the Basic Law of this land, the Declaration of Independence of 1776, it is not only the right but the God-given duty of the white populace to alter or abolish the present tyrannical government and to institute new guards for our future security against legal and armed repression, economic exploitation, and the murderous attacks of non-white savages.
And there was the readings of John Jewell, one of our best writers and one of the best fighters for the working man and the unions, white people. This is the way white working people used to take care of business. There's a whole new breed nowadays that don't compare in any way to our forefathers. The next reading is from July 2000. Let's back a ways. Called Survival Groups in Primitive Society by Ernst LaFleur. That was in our war newspaper, where you'll find a hell of a lot of great articles. In primitive society, the basic survival group is the tribe. It is a group of similar people tracing their blood to some common ancestor. A tribe is like a herd of muskox or a pack of hounds. They all look alike and act alike. They act in a group and survive as a group. And the laws of survival of the fittest apply to the whole group as a group. In ancient times, there were many tribes of men. These tribes were in contest for the limited means of support. The victorious tribe would drive the defeated tribe from their land and occupy it themselves. This process would continue until the weakest tribes were driven to the frigid Arctic or the disease-ridden jungles, with the most powerful tribes occupying the best parts of the temperate zone. Cro-Magnon man, from which Europeans are descended, entered Europe 30,000 years ago. He found Europe populated with the Neanderthal man and Negroes, as there is a Paleolithic evidence that Negroes did occupy parts of Europe before the entrance of Cro-Magnon man. The Cro-Magnon drove everything before him and exterminated the Neanderthal man and drove the Negro out of Europe. The Negro was harassed from one area to another. Some were driven south, some were driven north, as it is likely that the dark-skinned Eskimo is a remnant of this split. The major part, however, were driven to the disease-ridden jungle swamps of Africa, where no white man wanted to go. This process of the Cro-Magnon man taking over Europe is very similar to the process of the European man used in taking over the American continent from the Indian, the Mongoloid. He drove the Mongol before him or exterminated him if they did not move. Those Indians or Mongols who moved were driven to dry deserts, to the far north woods of Canada, and to the sultry swamps of Florida. These people who came to occupy Europe and the better parts of Asia represented the strongest survival groups in the world at that time. These ancient ancestors formed the basis of modern man. Later, the process continued, but between people of the same race. The people were divided into tribes, and these tribes were in constant contest for the best hunting areas and the most fertile ground. It came to be that the strongest tribes occupied the very best land and there settled down permanently. It would be impossible for them to settle down permanently unless they were absolutely the strongest. For if they were not strong, a strong tribe would come and attack them and drive them away, and they in turn would settle on that land. Thus, by the very operation of the laws of survival of the fittest, the strongest tribes would come to occupy the best lands and hold on to it, and not by driving away, not being driven away by anybody. Once they had settled down, they would begin a methodical expansion of producing babies from their own loins. They would have no desire to incorporate with the defeated tribe for two reasons. First, they would need all the support of the territory for themselves. That was what the war was about to begin with. Secondly, they would not want to incorporate with the defeated tribe in fear that it would weaken their own valiant qualities. Thus, the victorious tribe expanded from a fixed center by having babies. They simply increased themselves by breeding with themselves. as their tribe increased, it would be necessary to take in more and more territory. And they would do this by making war on their neighbors and driving them farther away. I quote Julius Caesar's commentary on the customs of the Germans. Caesar speaking, quote, "They, the German tribes, regard it as their highest distinction to lay waste their neighboring territory, and thus to have areas of wilderness as far and wide as possible around them. They consider it as proof of valor to drive their neighbors from their fields and to compel them to retire elsewhere." This is the way a tribe would expand. It would expand its own blood by driving its neighbors farther and populating the territory themselves. Within the tribes, the qualities most admired would be the qualities of valor and courage. They would be the qualities of a soldier. The survival of the tribe would depend on every man being a good soldier. These qualities, cowardly in battle, would neither be executed nor driven out of the tribe. Thus it came to be that the tribe itself was a product of selective breeding, selecting soldierly qualities and qualities of valor. It was in the tribe that man made his greatest biological progress. This is where the qualities that we so much admire in men today were brought to their perfection. And since this time, man was not made any significant biological progress. If anything, man has retrogressed from the high character he once possessed in the tribe. In addition to the qualities of valor, the qualities of intelligence, determination, fortitude, and outright grit were deliberately bred for in the tribe. Life was too stark and bare to tolerate degeneracy. Degeneracy within the tribe threatened the survival of the entire tribe, and the men of the tribe well understood what qualities were needed in order to survive. Thus, who did not contribute to the survival of the tribe were driven out. The tribe would attempt to strengthen itself in two ways. First, it would try to improve the quality of its own people, and two, it would try to increase the numbers of its people. It would improve the quality by removing the undesirable elements, and it would attempt to increase its numbers by acquiring more means of support, which meant war. It is often thought that war destroys the best man. This is true in one sense, and another sense not. The strong survival group will triumph over the weak one, and thereby increase itself even though it had to take an original loss to do so. The tribal government had one major end in view, and that was the survival of the tribe itself. It was to its interest to have the high character, self-sufficient man as soldiers to man the lines. Since this was their primary purpose, the government of the tribe attended to the breeding of its people like a master huntsman to his hounds. It was in Europe that this process was brought to its greatest perfection. This is what is meant when white men say they are superior to Negroes. They mean they are superior in their ability to make war, for a European tribe would be superior to a Negro tribe of equal numbers. If the Negroes had been superior in their ability to make war, they could have formed in armies and marched out of Africa, and nothing could have stopped them. But the fact is, the first hostile tribes they met stopped them. The reason the Negroes were in Africa to begin with is that they were drawn off the good parts of the earth. An army of 10,000 Negroes cannot stand up to an army of 10,000 Japanese or 10,000 Chinese or 10,000 Turks or 10,000 Europeans. And this is what Europeans mean when they say the Negro is inferior. He is inferior in his ability to make war. And to make war is the first requisite of survival, for without it, one will be conquered, defeated, and obliterated. And that's the end of the reading from Survival Groups in Primitive Society by Ernst LaFleur, War Newspaper, 2000. Again from 2000, War Newspaper. Did the Vikings develop a telescope? The Vikings could have been using telescope hundreds of years before the Dutch spectacle makers supposedly invented the device as late as the 16th century. This remarkable possibility has emerged from a study of sophisticated lenses just recognized from a Viking site on the island of Gotland in the Baltic Sea. They were initially thought to be merely ornaments. It seemed that the elliptical lens were initially the design was invented much earlier than we thought, and then the knowledge was lost, says Dr. Olaf Schmidt of the Aalen University in Germany. The late Dr. Karl-Heinz Wilms first heard of the so-called Visby lens in 1990 when he was searching for exhibits for a Munich museum. It was named after the major town of Gotland. Dr. Wilms found a picture of the lens in a book and planned to examine the original, but it was not until 1997 that a team of three scientists went to Gotland to take a close look at what were actually 10 lenses locked away in the storeroom of a local museum in perfect shape. One of the team, Dr. Olaf Schmidt, told BBC News Online, quote, "I was excited, of course. The polish of some of the lenses was almost perfect. The second thing which caught our eye was that their imaging was very good. When the lenses were put through their paces, the team was amazed. The lenses passed a series of tests almost as well as modern optics made from rock crystal. The lenses have an accurate shape that betrays the work of a master craftsman. The best example of the lenses measured 50 millimeters, 2 inches, in diameter and 30 millimeters, 1 inch thick at its center. Quote, the surface of some of the lenses have an almost perfect elliptical shape, Dr. Schmidt said. They were obviously made on a turning lathe. The lenses have a flattened central area and makes them excellent magnifiers. They could have been used as magnifiers, allowing fine carving to be carried out, or they could have been used to start fires or burn wounds and cuts so that they did not get infected. What intrigues the researcher is that the lenses are of such high quality and that they would have been used to make a telescope some 500 years before the first known crude telescopes were constructed in Europe in the last few years of the 16th century. Lost knowledge. The Gotland crystals provide the first evidence that sophisticated lens-making techniques were being used by craftsmen over 1,000 years ago. At that time, scientists had only just started to explore the laws of light refraction. According to the researchers, it is clear that the craftsmen who figured the lenses knew more about applied optics than did the scientists of the time. They must have worked by trial and error because the mathematics to calculate the best shape for a lens did not become available for several hundred years. The researchers speculate that the knowledge to make such an accurate lens was known to only a few craftsmen, perhaps only one person. But it seems clear that the Vikings did not make the lenses themselves. Quote, there are hints that the lenses may have been manufactured in the ancient empire of Byzantium or in the region of Eastern Europe, Dr. Schmidt said. Some of the lenses can be seen at Gotland's Fornsal, the historical museum in Visby. Some are in the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. Others have been lost. Pretty interesting, huh? They keep digging up more and more and more on a white man, and they haven't even begun. They haven't really begun, you know, the mysteries of the pyramids and all that stuff. This earth is so full of mysteries and mysteries about the progress of the white race, it's unbelievable. But the opponents of the white race do their best in many cases to suppress this information. They don't want the white race to be looking big and powerful. And so they do their best to forget about it and play it down. But there's far too many researchers now to keep it quiet. Even in Israel, there's information coming out by their researchers that most of the crap that these Zionists put out, historical Zionists, about all those people escaping Egypt and all that, is a whole lot of baloney. All those powerful, strong men of war were bullshit. Well, this story sure fits the news for today. Country slaughter in the big city. We have the honor of celebrating the 84th birthday of a man who tried in vain to stop America, today's nigger athlete worship by suicidal whites at its very beginning. Enos Bragshear Slaughter was born April 27, 1916, in Roxboro, North Carolina. Elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1985, he vowed at age 20 to give absolute maximum effort at all times his entire life. Thus was born one of the game's greatest hustlers. His nickname was Country, but his middle name was Consistency. His flat, level, lefty swing made him a 300 batter and an outstanding contact hitter in clutch situations. He is famous in baseball for two things: his mad dash home from first base on Harry Walker's double to win the 1946 World Series for the Cardinals, and two, his strident efforts to keep Major League Baseball segregated. Like the great Adrian Anson of the previous century, whose call to get the nigger off the field closed the field to those of darky persuasion, Slaughter tried his best to make folks understand that great men such as Thomas Jefferson and even Robert E. Lee hated slavery, but because of what it did to the mindless ones, but because they knew day-to-day physical integration would eventually lead to the social degradation we see today, where many young whites have sunk to the level of the most monstrous apes. Slaughter attempted to organize a baseball players' strike among the St. Louis Cardinals. It was perhaps only out of sheer frustration that he then went on the field with the nigger present and spiked little Jackie in the face on a base-stealing slide at second. Jackie Robinson, he spiked him in the face. Slaughter would tell people for years thereafter how sorry they would be one day, until he got tired of repeating himself. And so it is today that we have the absolute shameful and suicidal worship by white male team sports fans of their favorite criminal Negro athlete. Mein Gott, I've actually heard white guys in sports bars worry about whether their team, owned by the Jews in fact, should draft that great tailback and his downfield ability at receiving stolen goods, who only has one rape and one robbery conviction on his record, or perhaps that monster in the middle with only three drug convictions.